Thanks, Lou Larmony, for inviting me down to launch my book, This Being That Becomes. But happily for me, many of you spent the last 4 weeks having the book thoroughly discussed, so I don't really need to launch it. What I'll do now is spend 11 minutes, is that right? Recapping the last...
It's okay, 30 break is
that right? Okay. Between 11 and 13 and a half minutes. recapping what some of you have heard and what some of you haven't heard. So it'll be a bit dense if you haven't heard it, but no problem, you can always read the book. And then after the tea break, I'll give my talk, as it were, which is going to be specifically on interdependence and emptiness. Interdependence and emptiness, two ways of thinking about the Buddha's teaching on conditionality. But before we get to that, you need to know a bit about the Buddha's teaching of conditionality. So, the Buddha lived 2,500 years ago in India. He probably wasn't quite as muscular as that, but he meditated and he taught a path to what he called awakening, enlightenment, nirvana. And probably you're all aware that this certainly involves meditation. Some of you do mitra study and so on, so you're aware of the range of Buddhist doctrines and ideas. He taught a lot of ideas that pertained to awakening, but as well as being a teacher of a practical path, the Buddha was a philosopher, which is to say someone who thought deeply about the nature of reality. And underpinning all the Buddha's teachings and the path to awakening is the Buddha's basic philosophical teaching of conditionality. Now, in the Pali language, similar to what the Buddha spoke, this is known as paticca-samuppada, or in Sanskrit, praticca-samuppada, which means literally conditioned co-production, fantastic English phrase that doesn't mean anything, or dependent arising. So we're still working in a kind of philosophical code here. What this means is that things arise on particular conditions, and when those conditions cease, the things that depend on those conditions cease. So the Buddha taught a general principle of conditionality which runs: this being, that becomes. From the arising of this, that arises. This not being, that does not become. From the ceasing of this, that ceases. So that's where the title of my book comes from: This Being, That Becomes. It's the Buddha's general principle of conditionality. And I've said this is the core teaching of the Buddha. It underlies many of the conceptual expressions of the Dharma, which is to say the ideas the Buddha taught. But more than that, it expresses the nature of the reality that the Buddha discovered. I mean, there's only one reality, but the Buddha awakened to it. That's the teaching. And so everything being conditioned is that reality. But although that sounds quite, in a way, perhaps obvious or straightforward, the detail of the reality is a bit more difficult to get at. And so in this sense, the teaching of conditionality is, we call it a transcendental principle, which is to say it points to something which is beyond words and concepts. Everything arising and passing away all the time. If we could somehow feel our way into the everything arising and passing away, we'd understand how things are and not suffer. That's the theory. So that's the basic teaching. Jnanavacha talked about this in the first week. The recordings of those seminars are all available on the LBC website. Buddha applied this teaching of conditionality in two main ways. The first one are the 12 links of Paticcasamuppada, which you might know of. They're around the outside of the Wheel of Life, 12, as 12 pictures. If you haven't seen them, don't worry. You'll come across them at some point. They describe, or they're an account of, the nature of samsara, which is to say the cycle of rebirth, which is to say the nature of this existence, which we didn't choose to be in and which isn't perfect, and how it arises. And the key bit is it arises through craving. And you might think, well, craving, what's the problem with craving? The point is that through not knowing what we're doing, not quite understanding the situation, instead of looking into why we suffer, why life isn't perfect, we look for other kinds of solutions, or we push away from what's going on, or we just blank it out by getting drunk or something. And this is what's meant by craving. Craving, aversion, delusion are the kind of problems the Buddha pointed to as being the root of samsara. Happily, there's a way out. This starts with awareness, sati, mindful awareness, mindfulness. Some of you have probably done some mindfulness-based stress reduction, so you'll know that modern science has been picking up on the amazing value of awareness, how people can change the way their brains work, they can dehabituate their bodies from stress, they can start to find creative ways to address problems simply through taking a new approach to their experience based on deliberate attention rather than going with one's craving. So the other main application of conditionality is the spiral path, as we talk about it in Sri Ratna, which starts with awareness, or in some formulations, faith, and then proceeds through states of meditation to the crucial stage is insight, knowing and seeing things as they really are. And this means seeing into the nature of things as dependently arisen, seeing conditionality. And this application, this way conditionality works, is different from the way samsara works. Rather than being a closed cycle, there's an opening, a creative movement of conditions building on conditions, leading to awakening and liberation. Gosh, I'm really rushing through this, aren't I? Yeah. But this is just a recap, yeah? You can listen to the details on the website. So then Lilamani talked about how karma, the Buddha's teaching of karma, is related to the Buddha's teaching of conditionality. In the Buddhist tradition, you're probably aware that karma is said to be are those actions which lead to rebirth this way or another, which is true. That's what the Buddhist tradition teaches. But when we think about karma in relation to conditionality, a more very subtle perspective starts to come into play. How we act, the quality of our actions, determines our experience later on. That's the Buddha's teaching of karma. But in more detail, what counts is the intentional quality behind our actions, our intentions. Mental states of greed, hatred, and delusion, when we act from those mental states, lead to negative consequences. Intentions of contentment, love, and clarity lead to positive consequences, both to oneself and the world. So, in that sense, the conditions, mental conditions, such as cultivating contentment and clarity and metta, as we were doing this evening, actually lead to a transformation of experience. So that's how karma links with conditionality. Finally, Lilamani last week talked about how the teaching of conditionality has as its implication some definite ideas about the nature of existence or the texture of reality, as Sangharakshita, founder of Triratna, the Triratna movement, puts it. The Buddha taught there are three marks of conditioned existence. Firstly, everything's impermanent. If things arise on conditions and they pass away when those conditions cease, nothing can be permanent, nothing can stay unchanged. Well, I suppose it could if their conditions stayed unchanged, but they don't. So certainly in human experience, it's very hard to pin anything, to keep anything the same for very long. Experience constantly changes. There's arising, there's passing away. This is the texture of it. Because of that, any attempt to fix it and make it satisfactory by holding on to things is doomed to fail. So conditioned existence is dukkha, is unsatisfactory, leads to unease and difficulty. Or in fact it's painful. It's painful anyway actually, sometimes. But holding on to things doesn't help. So that's the second mark, suffering, dukkha. Thirdly, because things arise and pass away, there's no enduring essence to us or to anything. No enduring essence means our sense of being a self, being me, being I, is simply a thought, as it were. It's not enduring. Who you are changes. It can't last. Therefore, there's no permanent self. There you go. So, where's all this going? Buddhist insight practices actually begin from reflecting on these marks of existence, reflecting on impermanence, on unsatisfactoriness, on non-self. And by reflecting deeply on these things, one finds one's experience changed and one's mind being, as it were, liberated from the conditions of ignorance and craving. Clarity arises. Honestly. That's the teaching. Something that Lilani didn't mention, and she's exhorted me to mention, is we've talked about conditioned existence, the three marks of conditioned existence, but the Buddha also talked the unconditioned. Very mysterious, this. But the Buddha realised a state called nirvana. I'm sure you've heard this word, nirvana. And nirvana is the unconditioned. It's what doesn't arise on conditions. So there is something, if it's a thing, which doesn't arise on conditions. As it were, it's there. And it's, as it were, there when conditions cease. Now, the conditions that need to cease are greed, hatred and delusion. They're the mental conditions which lead to problems. So when those conditions cease, you can imagine your experience is free of those things. And to a degree, that is nirvana. But the Buddha also seemed to mean something a little bit deeper and very mysterious. By the word nirvana. So there is something beyond dependent arising, which is nirvana, the unconditioned. And rather than say any more, I'll stop there and we'll have a cup of tea. And then afterwards I'll talk about emptiness. But there's a question.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, of course.
Yeah. So can you explain conditionality? I'm not quite getting to it yet. So would it be possible to explain it by way of an analogy?
Well, it's everything, so analogies are hard, aren't they? But
because the process of learning is one by which you relate to something else, and if it's the fabric of nature,
yeah,
conditionality, then you must be able to see it in nature. You must be able to see it in the world and explain it by it.
Yeah, tell you what, rather than me say anything, I think what I'm going to say with regard to interdependence after the break will be an analogy. I think it's a useful analogy in the way you're asking for.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
So I'm going to talk about conditionality in terms of interdependence and emptiness. which is the theme of the final chapter of my book. Some of you may have read it. Otherwise, I'll say some things that also aren't really in the book, just to keep it interesting. But by way of introduction, when the Buddha's attendant, Ananda, said to the Buddha, "This business of conditionality is quite difficult, but it seems pretty clear to me." The Buddha replied, "Say not so, Ananda, say not so. Paticca-samuppada is deep and appears deep. It's through not understanding this teaching, which is deep and profound, that people are trapped in samsara," and so on. Which all struck me as interesting, because on the one hand, you know, you hear the teaching of conditionality, and it sounds like quite straightforward. I think, you know, everything arises on conditions. Oh yeah, that's, I knew that. So of course, what the Buddha was talking about was something perhaps a bit different, about how that impacts on our lives in ways that we didn't expect. And anyway, I mention that just to say that writing a book about this business is a real reminder of how difficult it is to understand this teaching. In a way, I think that's quite a gift for me, writing it. I've realised, you know, I don't understand this stuff. The best I can do is try and get across how I understand the Buddha to have taught these ideas. Does that make sense? As clearly as I can, you know, try and do good translations, explain it as best I can, whilst realising that, oh, blimey, I realise how much I don't understand. But perhaps something I have come to appreciate is that this business of conditionality, of paticca-samuppada, is really philosophical. It's the real thing, you know. It's serious philosophical thought, as far as the Buddha could manage in the intellectual context of his time. And that isn't for everyone. You don't need to be a philosopher to be a Buddhist. Does that make sense? The Buddha also taught the Dharma, not in philosophical terms, in pragmatic terms. You know, this is what you need to do, as it were, practice meditation, practice ethics. It's possible to build Sangha and transform the world. He also taught the Dharma in very emotional, heartfelt terms about the importance of love, the possibility of love and compassion for human beings. And you don't need to know about all this fancy stuff about paticca-samuppada to cultivate love. So really, the Buddha taught in different ways. That's what I'm getting at. So when we say conditionality is the essence of the Dharma, it's one of the essences of the Dharma, you could say. My book is mainly about the teaching of the Buddha. In trying to explain what turns out to be deep, serious philosophizing, I thought it best to focus on the Buddha's teaching as preserved in the Pali Canon. There's so much there, and it takes so much teasing out. I've just stuck with that topic and tried to explain it and clarify it as much as possible, with very little venturing into, as it were, contemporary terminology or ways of thinking. So the book comes across like a bit of an introduction to quite the Buddha's Indian way of thinking. But in chapter 8, I thought, I'll try and say something about how we might approach it from like a contemporary point of view. Not just that, also how later Buddhists developed the idea of paticca-samuppada, because they did. They built on the Buddha's teaching, at least to some degree. So it's of some interest to see how these ideas developed. Buddhism isn't Buddhism is impermanent. It keeps changing, yeah? It keeps developing new ideas. The Dharma isn't fixed. So I'll talk about some ways of thinking about conditionality, which weren't talked by the Buddha, basically, this evening. And I'll start with interdependence, the idea of interdependence, because I think it's resonates with us, or could resonate with us more naturally in the contemporary world. The idea that things are interdependent, things depend on each other, things are interconnected, is one way of talking about it. I prefer interdependence. To say things are interconnected is kind of obvious, to say they connect, but to say they depend on each other is to sort of raise the stakes for of how things relate a bit more. The Buddha didn't teach interdependence, actually. But it's a powerful way, I think, to understand what the Buddha was getting at. And the gentleman who asked the question about wanting an analogy for dependent arising has disappeared by the look of the
Pardon? He's gone.
He's gone. Oh, well. So here's the analogy. I suppose he can listen to the recording, can't he, if he wants. So things depend on each other. Everything depends on other things. Let's just think about an example. Let's think about my book. Gives me a chance to hold it in the air as well, doesn't it? To say this book is interdependent, what does that mean? Well, it's made of paper. That paper comes from trees. No trees, no book. No trees, no paper, no book. Does that work? Are they? Can you see the conditions that are necessary for the book there? We haven't got interdependence, so much dependence, I think, there. But when we get to the trees, we have trees being dependent on the sun and the rain. But I think we could agree that trees are also somewhat interdependent with the rain, that forests affect climate quite largely, to some degree. So there's an interdependence between trees and weather, without which no book. That's the important thing. That's just to talk about the material existence of the book, which, after all, it could be electronic. It would be exactly the same book, but no paper. So whether it's paper or electronic, it depends on its author, obviously. But I've been changed by writing this, so there's a bit of interdependence there. But, you know, my understanding has come from my being part of the Triratna movement, studying with order members. It all goes back to Sangharakshita's presentation of the Dharma, which itself comes from Sangharakshita's teachers and his reading, and all that goes right back to the Buddha. We've got a network of connections there, which at a certain point, it's not that without any one of them there wouldn't be this book, but actually this book exists, and therefore all those conditions have been in place, as it were, have been part of the coming to be of that book, of this book. But the book also requires an audience. The commission wouldn't have come from Windthorst Publications and Satchinama, the Mitra convener who organised it, if there weren't wasn't a Mitra Sangha, if there weren't people who wanted to read such a book. So the book is entirely interdependent on its potential audience. Does that make sense? I mean, nobody prints books without an audience. Well, people do print books without an audience, but then they don't sell. I mean, that kind of interdependence is interesting, I think, because it shows off how, by conditionality, we don't necessarily mean causality, causation. The potential readership of a book doesn't cause the book. You know, there's no causation involved there. It's more like in the broader way of considering conditions for the arising of something, the potential audience for a book is a condition that makes it possible. So conditionality is a much bigger, is a broader, more inclusive concept than causality. That's a philosophical distinction which we could explore a lot more, but I'll leave there. So I'm trying to evoke interdependence, just starting with the example of a book. I think in contemporary culture, interdependence has become much more a theme in ecology, and hence in considerations of human impact on the world, on global warming and so on. It turns out that the way the living world works is only makes sense if you take into account how things depend on each other in complex ways. Ecosystems are not the product of simply one line of causation, but they are the product of heaps and heaps of complex interrelating elements. I'm not an expert in that stuff, so I'm not going to even give an example, I don't think. But as long as that, to some degree, works for you, I just want to leave it there to suggest that interdependence is pretty much what the... I want to suggest that that's what the Buddha was getting at with his teaching of conditionality, that our experience, what happens in human experience, is interdependent with many, many factors in our lives, in the world. And by seeing that, to some extent, we start to understand our lives in a truer way. So in that sense, thinking about interdependence is a way to appreciate the teaching of anatman, of anatta, of no self or insubstantiality, which is one of the supposed to be one of the marks of conditioned existence, seeing which leads to insight. I've got a little exercise for you to do here. I'm kind of interested. I haven't done this before, so I'm interested to know if it's going to work. Turn to someone, or get together in threes, doesn't matter really, and try this. Can you find a way or ways, and it's helpful if you don't know each other, how about that? Way or ways in which you two are interdependent. Yeah? In which your lives depend on each other. Now, I don't mean like in big ways, it could be like a teeny tiny way, yeah, in which your lives somehow are interdependent. Perhaps one of you is a bus driver and the other one of you caught a bus to get here. Yeah? Bus drivers need passengers. Passengers need bus drivers. Or just find some way in which your lives touch. Okay? Did you find anything? Did you find any?
Yes.
Are there any examples then?
Too much.
Friends of the Tate.
Wow.
Yeah. We both like the mirror exhibition.
Okay.
A lot of it, although I've got a degree in fine art, a lot of it was absolutely brand new to me, his early work and his later work. I regarded him as a dotty painter, and we're both the same, basically. So there's an immediate connection.
Lovely. Great. Anything else?
I have a mirror,
but
I went to that.
You should have come and joined us.
Our forebears were both Jewish people who came to the East End, and Debbie was born in the East End. Were you born there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So quite a an ancestral connection. Thank you. Yes.
So Rebecca's a lawyer. So first she thought, oh, then there wasn't a connection. But then I realised that to live in a country that is relatively law-abiding, well, it just has a huge effect on my life. That I feel the absence of that very strongly.
Yeah.
So the fact that people keep the law and give one a fair trial has a bigger effect than I realised. It made me realise that more effect than I thought.
And you teach ethics.
Yes.
Might be putting lawyers out of work.
We discussed how last year I was a student, and so obviously these guys were paying into state, into the government, in order for me to borrow money from everybody in this room.
That's horrible.
It pays that. It would just get ages.
That's really nice. Yeah.
And when we're pensioners, what kind of...
You can get your own pension.
Yeah, we found we both knew George. Now, George runs a health food shop in Well Street, and we lived quite close.
Right.
So, twins, we kept him going.
So, yeah, George depends on you. Yeah. Yes. Well, you depend on, both depend on George.
Yes, they depend on George.
So great, thanks. That was a nice experiment. I mean, there's definitely some interdependence there between George and yourself and George and Shrivati, but you've simply realised that, as it were, in that particular example. Otherwise, hearing about Miro and the Miro bag and law and ethics and so on, I'm more struck by how being an individual in modern society places us in a very complicated network of institutions and interests and cultural formations and so on, which probably most of the time we don't necessarily think of as think of ourselves as being quite so suspended in. We're more caught up in our own lives, I suppose. But here we all are, as it were, noticing that we're all active parts, as it were, of a culture, of modern culture. That's just my response, hearing what you said. So we're not, by talking about interdependence, we're not so much thinking philosophically about conditionality. It's just expanding our sense of what it might mean as a concept. And I'd like to go a bit further now, just to mention a Buddhist scholar called Joanna Macy. Some of you might be aware of her through her activist work. She's pioneered this form of workshop called The Work That Reconnects, helping people to come into become consciously aware of how they feel about things like global warming and in the old days nuclear weapons. So she's a smart sort of woman, but she did a PhD in Buddhist philosophy at a certain stage, and she's written one of the few books on conditionality that there are, and it's called Mutual Causality in Buddhism and Systems Theory. Fantastic title. And I think she makes a very valuable contribution by making the point that the Buddha's teaching of conditionality does not imply linear causality, which is how we tend to think about the nature of conditionality. Because modern science has been so successful in finding patterns and explanations for events, in terms of chains of causes, we tend to think of reality in those ways. So the very simple example of billiard balls knocking into each other and then transferring their energy in precisely causal ways is like a basic example following Newtonian mechanics. In order to explain the universe in these kind of terms, you need to reduce it to simple elements. So there's a reductionist kind of assumption in modern science, which is great for explaining things. But in terms of our understanding, our own experience, it doesn't much help. We can come to psychologies like behaviourism, which suggests that our behaviours follow from certain forms of stimulus-response kind of patterns, but that takes no account of what it's like to be a conscious human being, as far as I'm concerned. Joanna Macy's scholarship makes the point, she brings into communication systems theory from modern science and the Buddhist teaching. In systems theory, which is designed to help us explain how ecosystems work, what's at play is mutual causal relationships. So things happen and affect each other through processes of feedback in non-linear, unpredictable kind of ways. So again, not my stuff, so I'm not going to put my foot in it, but weather is a good example. Yeah. From a certain point of view, we know what goes into weather. There's sunshine, the Earth's movement, there's air, and so on. But as it turns out, what the weather will be is not easy to predict. You know, the BBC manages 80% correctness. But apparently, if you just say the weather tomorrow will be the same as today, you're going to be right 75% of the time. So, and the reason is the weather systems are complex non-linear causal systems. The variables affect each other. A lovely example of non-linear causal systems are sand ripples on beaches. I'm going to show you a picture from the book. I don't know if you can see that. I've just found a nice picture of sand ripples on a beach. So infinitely complex, varying kind of patterns within very strict parameters. You know, they're never more than so high. They ripple in the same kind of way. But the patterns continually vary because they're produced by the interplay of the tide and the sand in ways that you can't predict until you get right down to the tiniest level. Well, nobody can predict them, basically. It's so complicated what's going on in a non-linear kind of way. I also wanted to have something quirky in the book, so a picture of sand ripples. I thought, who would have expected that? The point of talking about sand ripples and weather is to suggest that in some way human experience is a bit like this, I think. What goes on doesn't arise on conditions in a linear way. So our suffering, the dukkha, the unsatisfactoriness of experience, I don't think necessarily you're going to find single conditions which give rise to it. Maybe you know, you might find a single condition which causes you problems. Then, of course, you can work with that. But probably most of us have got complicated habitual sort of patterns going on, which causes problems and we'd like to change. Or we, to put it the positive way, to develop as individuals, to realise some of the potential for love, wisdom, creativity that we all have. The process of doing it involves engaging in a development process which is not linear. You don't just meditate, become enlightened. Well, it'd be great if we did, but it doesn't happen like that. We engage in a process which is very hard to understand and becomes quite complicated when we try to do so, because non-linear kind of causal conditioning processes are involved. It's like learning to dance, you'd say. I've mentioned Joanna Macy and non-linear causal systems and interdependence, hoping that these concepts, which come out of reflecting on modern science and how we explain the world, helps us to understand more fully what the Buddha was talking about. Yeah. So, when the Buddha taught the 12 links of dependent arising, and the spiral path to awakening, although they're presented as 12 links in a chain, yeah, I think it's best to think that's just a way of presenting them. That's just a way of teaching a complicated doctrine. Actually, in order to speak and write, we have to put things in order. That's how it is. So, you know, teaching and writing, language is a linear process. But that doesn't mean reality has to be like that. And in fact, when you start looking at the Buddha's teachings on on conditionality, how the links, the individual links of the 12 links are presented, for instance, how craving is presented in the Buddha's teaching, it turns out there's lots of different presentations in which the Buddha draws attention to various kinds of loops and conditioning factors involved almost at every stage. As you can imagine, nothing is quite simple. So I think thinking in terms of non-linear causal systems, interdependence as non-linear causal processes, is helpful for us to, as a paradigm, as it were, as a model of what the Buddha was trying to get at. I'd just like to emphasise again that the Buddha didn't actually teach like this. He didn't teach interdependence. And Joanna Macy's work with systems theories comes from scientific theories about nature, as it were, whereas the Buddha's teaching is about human experience. So there is a kind of gap, and I'm just using systems theory as an analogy. Also, some people don't think Joanna Macy's stuff is very appropriate for illustrating the Buddha's teaching. I'm not so. I obviously I think it is, but I don't want you saying Devon says that the Buddha teaches interdependence, because I'll get into trouble. If that makes sense, I think interdependence is a useful way for us to approach the Buddha's teaching. The Buddha himself, he always taught conditionality as a way to appreciate how things arise on conditions and cease again. Arising and passing away. The reason you study conditionality, according to the Buddha, is to see arising and passing away. To see impermanence. Yeah, that's how the Buddha always taught it. Whereas thinking about interdependence is, as it were, to look at things from, instead of in relation to time, in relation to space, as it were, to think about how things are related, how everything's related. So, although the Buddha didn't teach like that, I think it is a valid approach, as it were, parallel to the Buddha's. The Buddha's target, this is important, in teaching conditionality, was the Atman, the permanent self that the religious teachers, the Brahmins of the Buddha's time, taught as the aim of spiritual practice. So for the Brahmins of the Buddha's time, the point of the nature of reality was that there is a permanent self, which, if you can realise it, will allow you to become one with the nature of the universe. Yeah? So there's something in you which is identical with the true nature of the universe. And if you can find it, then you're saved, as it were. Whereas the Buddha said there isn't an Atman at all. There isn't a permanent self. And reality doesn't have an essence. So he took a very different approach. So I mention that because it could be that you think that interdependence, the idea that everything depends on each other, might lead to the conclusion that, as it were, in the background, there's a sort of oneness in the universe. As it were, interconnectedness means there's a sort of oneness. And if we are part of this oneness, this interconnected whole, that's the solution. But actually, that wouldn't be Buddhism. That would be the problem. It would be a kind of way of thinking about things which isn't Buddhism. So I've started by talking about interdependence as a way to think about conditionality, but now I've made it difficult and complicated again by saying that interdependence can lead you kind of astray a bit if you think about it as the whole, as the nature of reality. However, just to put it in context, I think, for instance, when we sit down to eat a meal, if we look at our food and just consider all the conditions that are needed to be in place for this food to be here, to sustain us now, it can have a tremendous effect on contextualising, as it were, our present experience. Usually when we come to eat, we want a bit of comfort, we feel excited about eating something, or slightly bored, or in a rush, or just doing something very habitually. But actually, we spend so much of our time eating, and it's so completely crucial to our existence, and in fact a lot of our emotional well-being, to think about where our food comes from, the effort certain people have made for it to end up there. It can help us come into relationship with wider society, I think, very well, to think about conditions in that way. So I'm not saying, I think reflexive interdependence is a very positive kind of thing to do. But, however, nevertheless, when it comes to thinking about the nature of reality, interdependence, up to a point, can reflect the Buddha's teaching, but kind of falls because it doesn't necessarily challenge our assumptions too much. It doesn't really lead us to the nub of things. So now I'm going to talk about emptiness, because this is a solidly Buddhist kind of doctrine. Way of talking about the nature of reality. So right at the heart of the Buddhist tradition. Emptiness. This is a translation of the Sanskrit word shunyata. You might have come across this term, shunyata. It translates emptiness or sometimes voidness. I don't really like the term voidness. Doesn't do much for me, but sometimes we need to try different translations to see what works for us, or insubstantiality, that sometimes works for people. The Buddha didn't connect conditionality with emptiness. The Buddha did teach emptiness, actually. There are a few places in the early scriptures of the Pali Canon where the Buddha discusses sunyata, emptiness, in terms of how, from the point of view of awakening, the self and the world are empty, and they're empty of the self and what belongs to the self. So to put it in another way, the Buddha taught that we can understand our experience in terms of five khandhas, or constituents. Form, I can't explain these, I don't think. I'll just, for those of you who have heard of them, I'll just list them. Form, feeling, perception, formations, and consciousness. The Buddha often invited his followers to reflect on their experience in terms of these constituents, these elements of what it is to be a person, and invited them, can you find a self? Can you find you in your experience anywhere? If you think about form, your body, can you find your sense of I, of who you think you are? Or if you look into your feelings, which is to say your sense of pleasant and unpleasant or neutral. Or if you look into your perceptions, which is to say all your sense perceptions, visual, auditory, bodily touch sensation, perceptions. Is there a self there? Is what actually you find is everything's changing all the time. That's what the Buddha said, anyway, that you're likely to find. So what you don't find is a permanent self. In fact, you don't find a permanent self anywhere. In that sense, the Buddha said, experience is empty. And it's empty, not in the sense of an empty bucket, which is empty of water, but in the sense of an empty dwelling or an empty forest, which is to say uninhabited, kind of wild, untamed. That's what it's like inside, if you look closely enough. But the Buddha didn't connect this idea of experience as empty from an awakened point of view with conditionality. And that connection fell to later Buddhists. And the most important one is a philosopher called Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna, from the 2nd century, roughly, AD, in India. He's often called the second Buddha, actually. Which, you know, who knows if that's true. We don't know anything about him, unfortunately, apart from he was the author of some very difficult Sanskrit philosophical texts. But he did something rather brilliant, which is to connect up the Buddha's teaching of conditionality with emptiness. In fact, he said that in fact, that really, conditionality is the same as emptiness. If I just read out a verse from his main work, the verses on the middle way, the root verses on the middle way. He said, we claim that dependent arising is emptiness, which notion, once acquired, is truly the middle way. Since there does not exist anything which is not dependently arisen, so there does not exist anything that is not empty. Once you read it, it seems obvious. If things arise on conditions and cease when those conditions cease, what kind of essence can things have? What kind of independent existence can things have? If they depend on other things to exist, and when those other things cease to exist, they cease. Can things have own being? I think it's easiest to think about this in terms of your mental states, actually. If you think about happiness, I'm sure once or twice all of us have experienced a bit of happiness, at least when we're children, perhaps. When we're happy, it seems like quite a self-sufficient state of well-being, doesn't it? Life is just fine. We don't need to think about anything else. And yet we know perfectly well from our adult point of view that experience existed for a while under certain conditions. And when those conditions ceased, the experience changed into something else. And so it goes on. So it's not that we necessarily think happiness has intrinsic existence, exists as such, but perhaps what we don't realise is that it doesn't have any intrinsic existence at all. It's a word which we give to an experience which arises and passes away. But actually, while it's there, it's simply something that depends on lots of things. So we've got a word, so we suppose it's there. But look closely, is there any intrinsic existence? And what Nagarjuna tries to highlight is that things are empty of intrinsic existence. If they're dependently arisen, they completely lack intrinsic existence. Anyway, nothing either exists nor non-exists, or not exists. There is simply a flow of dharmas, of things that depend on other things. Dharmas that all arise on certain conditions, last a while, I mean, it could be a long time, and pass away again. This is what there is. This is the nature of reality. This is the implication of dependent arising. See, now, if we think that conditionality means this emptiness, we can see that the idea that interdependence might make us feel good, you know, that interconnectedness is a sort of positive thing. We can see the problem with that, because at a deeper level, the level that the Buddha was trying to get across, things don't really exist. They are flowing processes, which it's impossible to hold on to. And that's why it isn't the case, from the Buddhist point of view, that there is a oneness in reality to which, if we could attain it, if we could find that in ourselves, that permanent part of ourselves which is the same as that which is permanent in the universe, that's why that isn't the case in Buddhism, because from the Buddhist point of view, things are simply empty. The true nature of reality is simply the process of flowing dharmas. And the Dharma life, the living of the Dharma life, is the realization of emptiness as ultimate reality. This doesn't mean that there isn't anything there, if you see what I mean. Emptiness is at the same time, being the true nature of things, is just how things are. So we can still say meditation cushion, or we can say Shrivati. We can use these words to point to actually existing beings, things, which are there as flowing processes of arising and passing away dharmas, of mental estates, and so on. So this perspective of emptiness is actually the ultimate perspective of Buddhism. It's the way in awakened beings see things. There's nothing to be gained from existence, nothing to be got rid of. There's just this flowing process of things. There's just this moving emptiness. Hence, what one needs to do is simply relax into open awareness of the nature of things, of this vast, inconceivable suchness of things. That sounds so easy, doesn't it? Of course, that's the whole point. It's an extremely hard thing. I've just said you can do this, but of course that's what Buddhas do. This is what our muscular friend is doing here, just relaxing into the into open awareness of vast arising and passing away of dharmas. There's a great danger of grasping this teaching of wrongly, actually. If you think you understand this, you're really in trouble. The Nagarjuna said, when viewed wrongly by those of weak intelligence, emptiness is disastrous, like a snake handled wrongly, or a wrongly prepared spell. Actually, that word spell, I'm not sure how to translate it. I'm not sure anybody does. But so we don't know if he believed in spells. But the important point here, I think, is that emptiness is not something you can understand. This perspective of everything being simply a process, a dynamic process of changing arisings and passings away, means that you can't get this with your mind. Does that make sense? You can appreciate it with... Well, no, it doesn't make sense. That's what he said. It doesn't make sense. You can appreciate it at a... perhaps at a heart level, but an intuitive level, eventually. But I think it is possible to say that we perhaps get glimpses of this perspective of emptiness, perhaps in meditation, perhaps when we're doing just sitting, which is to say, perhaps we've been meditating quite intensely and then we stop making any effort. We don't try and do anything. And just at that moment, no effort, we find ourselves just aware of everything that's happening. Sights, sounds, our own mental states, arising, passing away. No argument. Actually, no thoughts. There's complete clarity. No argument. That's a little taste of emptiness. Sometimes, perhaps, when we're listening to music, so for some of us, or for some of us reading poetry, perhaps, or looking at Miro in the tape. Perhaps I don't know about Miro. We can find ourselves caught up in our own interest and passion for something, such that our sense of us isn't there, and yet our experience is happening. We're perfectly concentrated. Music's a good example because it's moving, I think. And in fact, the beauty of it is in our exposure to the change of that's going on, the rising and falling of notes, the complexity of harmony and counterpoint. This is another sort of little, well, analogy, I suppose, for the perspective of emptiness. So that's simply me trying to evoke a bit about emptiness. In fact, the Buddhist tradition, since Nagarjuna, has developed many, many ways to conceptually analyse emptiness. This is what Tibetan Buddhists do a great deal. You might have heard of the Madhyamaka school of Tibetan of Buddhist philosophy. This is concerned with analysing the concept of emptiness. The point being that if you can come to a conceptual understanding of it, then you can convert that into some kind of more intuitive awareness. But for us now, I'm just suggesting that emptiness is in a way the ultimate expression in the Buddhist tradition of what the Buddha was teaching with conditionality. And I think at that point I shall cease, as it were, having started. So we've just got about 5 minutes for any questions before I'm going to need to leave, actually, at 9:45 to catch a train. But we've got a couple of minutes for questions.
Thinking about the concept of Buddha nature, how does that fit in now? Because I've heard two interpretations. One is emptiness, and the other one is something, but it's not quite like emptiness. So what would you say?
What's the something? You don't...
Well, it's something that... as I understood it, the different people got different ideas. More to do with some kind of transcendental input, which together with the emptiness makes a mixture. Well, it sounds like a cocktail, but this is sort of trying to explain how it's a bit more complicated than the actual emptiness itself, which is sort of a rules.
Yeah, I have to say, I really don't know the answer to that one. The way my mind works, I can only understand Buddha nature, which is to say the doctrine that all of us have the potential to become Buddhas without having to change ourselves. No, sorry. Right now, we have the potential to become Buddhas without needing to be other than we are, as it were. And that potential is found in... actually there's only emptiness. So if you can understand emptiness, being conscious beings, we're capable of understanding emptiness, and in that sense we're capable of becoming Buddhas. But you can see I don't really have a very detailed grasp on this. I don't know if anybody else has.
What you talk is, what for me is to question the predictability of life, because I feel like we predict on a constant basis, and the huge scope of conditionality makes me really, the way you present it makes me question that.
I think something about conditionality which I didn't mention was that it's a sort of middle way between determinism on the one hand, which is to say everything's fixed by natural laws or by karma, if you think in terms of karma. It's a middle way between that and randomness or chaos. So the Buddha certainly said the universe isn't random and chaotic. Things arise on conditions. But things arising on conditions doesn't mean everything's completely determined. So your fate is being decided, before you were born. Because as actually we have the power to initiate new actions, being conscious beings. So there's room to manoeuvre. So there's some predictability in the situation. But life isn't predictable, is that?
I think it takes the edge off, when you're predicting what's going to happen next, it's not as exciting.
Ah, okay.
What's going to happen in this tour, what's going to happen, you're thinking with somebody that's going the whole time, it's a closing down,
Is that not how we function in the world anyway? You don't function on the assumption that anything could happen at any moment. You function on the assumption that things are predictable, the pavement will continue to be there for us. That's how we work in the world. I don't think we could work if we thought everything might suddenly disappear.
Well, I've heard that a lot of monks just turn their cups upside down in the night, not predicting that they would actually wake up in the morning. If you live so extremely, it would be quite exciting.
Yeah, the Buddha recommended actually that you meditate as if you're going to die in the morning, which is of course always a possibility. actually. Yeah. Because that really puts an edge on things.
Excuse me, do you follow that approach?
Me?
Yourself, yes. Yeah,
pardon?
And you've written this book, so obviously you know a lot about these things.
Yeah.
Tried and tested. Did you meditate like that, that you might die in the morning?
No, I don't.
It tends to be easier to know things intellectually than time.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Can you speak about the relationship between love and compassion and emptiness? Because I feel like after this talk, they seem so disconnected.
Yeah.
I don't know how they.
Yeah. I suppose my understanding of the Buddha's teaching on metta is that when we appreciate that all living beings, like ourselves, wish to be happy, we find ourselves empathizing with them. Just like me, they want to be happy. I want to be happy. Well, you know, self-metta makes sense to me because I want to be happy and want my life to be something worthwhile and meaningful. Actually, all living beings want to be like that. And the perspective of emptiness, in a way, is the systematic breaking down of all the non-ultimate distinctions between us. You know, we've got distinct bodies, but you know, our minds work in just the same way. Mine and everybody else's in the world, even people who are acting in really crazy ways. So my understanding of the cultivation, you know, the perception of emptiness, is that actually it's closely connected with the development of compassion as an actual perception. I think that's the best I can do in 1 minute. Yeah. I think I shall stop there.
Yeah, Divan, thank you so much for coming to class, and I think he deserves a big round of applause.